Former President Donald Trump's attacks on social media over his fourth indictment put him in further legal peril.
The more this president talks, the more he actually exposes himself to not just proving up the crimes that are being held against him, but even some of the other allegations that have been thrown his way.
Plus, on the wildfire-ravaged Hawaiian island of Maui, survivors of the tragedy are experiencing serious emotional trauma.
A lot of people are still in a state of shock, but that many people will probably be dealing with post-traumatic stress symptoms and anxiety long-term, possibly even the rest of their life.
And the music genre hip-hop celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Today is Wednesday, August 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has been expressing his anger on social media as he now faces a fourth indictment issued by a grand jury in the state of Georgia, accusing him of illegally trying to overturn his 2020 election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Associated Press correspondent Shelley Adler takes a look at where the latest criminal charges go from here.
Now that ex-President Donald Trump and 18 allies have been indicted in Georgia, what's next?
At this point, it's about herding all the cats into the courtroom and get them to make an initial appearance, to have lawyers who are permanently going to represent them, to enter their not guilty pleas.
Former federal prosecutor David Weinstein. And what about DA Fani Willis's goal of starting that trial in 6 months?
I think she's being very ambitious to suggest that case can go to trial in 6 months, which goes back to why in some of the other cases there have been less defendants, co-defendants charged in an effort to streamline those cases.
The DA says the defendants in the case would be allowed to voluntarily surrender by noon, August 25th. I'm Shelley Adler.
Trump, his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and possibly others are trying to have the case in the state of Georgia moved to the federal courts. I spoke with criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice about why Trump would want this case tried in a federal court rather than by the district attorney in Georgia.
There's a couple of reasons. The first one actually has to do with the pardon process itself. If Donald Trump were to become president, there is the potential that he could actually pardon himself from federal crimes. He does not have the ability, the power to pardon himself for state crimes. Remember, this indictment is not for federal crimes. It's for state crimes in Georgia. And in the United States, there's really two systems that run parallel. The federal system on one side and each individual state system on the other. So there's 50 of those running. This one applies specifically to what happened in Georgia. There's actually another reason, though, too. And that has to do with the laws that would apply in this case, because there are something called RICO laws, and those usually have to do with something called money laundering, bribery. It's really about going after the mob. That's why the federal government set this up. But there is actually a more aggressive version of RICO in Georgia. That's actually the statute that they're prosecuting former President Trump under. And so there is this potential that if this were pushed into the federal courts, that it's possible the prosecutors would be stuck with a more limited version of RICO, and that would be easier to defend against. So that's one of the other reasons that the former president would probably prefer. Frankly, there's actually a third one. What you really don't want to have to do is go try this case in Georgia when the people who are going to be prosecuting you are really good at Georgia law, really good at Georgia RICO, and really have the ability to come after this president, especially when the former governor, the former secretary of state, both Republicans came out and said there was no theft of an election in this case, and they pushed back hard on the president.
How does this type of law that's used against mobsters apply to Trump and his allies?
Remember, there are two things going on. There is the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, hence RICO. That is a federal crime, and that was designed to go after mobsters. So in other words, to go after money laundering, bribery, drug trafficking, that sort of thing. In fact, the real idea was to set up and go after organizations for the things that the organization as a whole does and hold the people at the top of the heap liable, responsible. And so that's a big piece of this. However, in this case, they're actually using a Georgia version, a state court version of that RICO law. This was adopted about 10 years later. And that RICO version is more expansive than the original federal version. So in other words, they can go after those individuals and that organization for just attempting to do certain things as part of this enterprise. And by the way, in this indictment, the indictment talks about 161 individual acts by this group of people to try to get this outcome. That is an extraordinarily powerful indictment in Georgia state court. The DA in this case of Fulton County, she has used this law before. When I read the indictment, I saw the very first count was a RICO count. And that really matters because, again, even in Georgia law, the real purpose of this is to look at an organization as a whole and hold the people at the top of it responsible for what the other people are doing. And so you don't have to find Trump's fingers on it directly. You can find others responsible and then hold him liable, responsible for what they have done. You have a prosecutor who has done this multiple times in the past, as recently as 2020, and he's really good at it. So you have an expert going after lawyers who are going to be brought in who may not be experts.
Donald Trump has really wasted no time on social media going after this district attorney before and even after this indictment came out Monday night. Would that provide any further legal peril for him in this case?
There's no question about it. The more this president talks, the more he actually exposes himself to not just proving up the crimes that are being held against him, but even some of the other allegations that have been sort of thrown his way, including going after the federal judge in the Washington, D.C. case, where he started talking about that judge again, which is something he was already warned not to do. Federal judges, they don't give you a lot of room. They can be really aggressive and they could throw you in jail just for contempt. It'll be interesting to see how this judge, and frankly, all of these four different sets of indictments will actually play out, because now they're starting to converge from all sides.
Thanks so much for the perspective. That was criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. Hawaii officials are working painstakingly to identify the 99 people confirmed dead in wildfires that ravaged Maui. A mobile morgue arrived Tuesday to help in that process, even as teams intensified the search for bodies in neighborhoods reduced to ash. Crisis counselor Dana Lucio says the emotional trauma for survivors will be a long and difficult process.
I spoke to one gentleman who lost his home, his wife and kids, and his vehicle, and I think he said his job also burned down. So he's literally lost everything.
President Biden on Tuesday promised to be there for the people of Maui.
Our thoughts and prayers with the people of Hawaii, but not just our prayers. Every asset they need will be there for them.
And while he does plan to visit, he's not sure when.
My wife Jill and I are going to travel to Hawaii as soon as we can. That's what I've been talking to the governor about. I don't want to get in the way. I've been to too many disaster areas, but I want to go make sure we got everything they need.
Meanwhile, members of the Canadian Armed Forces mobilized in the Northwest Territories on Tuesday as wildfires there threatened communities, including the territorial capital, as hundreds of people were airlifted to safety. Russian forces unleashed a barrage of missiles on regions across Ukraine early Tuesday morning, killing civilians and damaging civilian infrastructure. We hear more from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The Ukrainian Air Force says Russia fired a total of 28 cruise missiles at the country. 16 of them were intercepted, the statement says. Presidential advisor Mikhail Podolyak said on X, formerly known as Twitter, that the deliberate large-scale attacks were aimed at civilians, solely, he adds, for the sake of killing and psychological pressure. The barrage came just hours before top Russian military officials and their counterparts from Asia, the Middle East and Africa gather outside Moscow for a security conference where the fighting in Ukraine is likely to dominate the agenda. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And Poland on Tuesday held its largest military parade in 29 years, a display of strength aimed at neighbors Belarus and Russia, and a sign that Polish attitudes on defense are changing in the wake of Russian aggression in Ukraine. For VOA, Lizja Wakalec reports from Warsaw. saw.
2,000 soldiers, 200 units of Polish and foreign-made military equipment, and 92 aircraft. This was Warsaw's largest military parade in almost three decades. The parade included M1 A1 Abrams tanks bought from the U.S., K2 tanks, and K9 self-propelled howitzers bought from South Korea, Alzheimer's rocket launchers, and Patriot air defense systems. Polish military analyst Jarosław Wolski says the parade is a display of the country's military power.
We cannot afford to show weakness because, unfortunately, the only language Russians and Belarusians understand is the language of strength. We demonstrate new equipment and that our army is changing.
According to Wolski, changes in the Polish army began long before the war in Ukraine started, but Russia's aggression in Ukraine accelerated Poland's modernization of its arsenal.
Two factors played a role here, the increase in funding and the need to urgently fill the shortage of equipment, since we transferred about 30% of the land forces equipment to Ukraine.
Since 2010, the Polish army has been a fully professional force after mandatory military conscription was abolished. Most soldiers come through military schools. To increase the army size, Poland recently instituted a system that gives volunteers a chance to become reserves, explains Colonel Justyna Balik, a spokeswoman for Poland's Central Military Recruitment Office.
Takie szkolenie na terenie jednostki trwa 27 dni. Tam są podstawy, czyli regulaminy, musztra, taktyka, szkolenia strzeleckie, czyli takie wszelkie podstawy dla żołnierza. I po tym szkoleniu, które trwa 27 dni, ci żołnierze składają przysięgę wojskową. I wtedy ci żołnierze decydują, czy chcą dalej kontynuować ten swój rozwój jako bycia w Wojsku Polskim, czyli...
According to Colonel Balik, 70% of volunteers decide to continue their career in the army.
Plan na ten rok, jeśli chodzi o rekrutację żołnierzy, wynosił 25,000 żołnierzy, ale już na chwilę obecną wiemy, że ten cel zostanie osiągnięty z nadwyżką, bo już teraz mamy ponad 21,000 żołnierzy, którzy przeszli przeszkolenie podstawowe, złożyli przysięgę wojskową.
By 2035, Poland plans to almost double the size of its army, from 175,000 to 300,000. Waldemar Skrzypczak, a retired general and former commander of the Polish Land Forces, explains why the build-up is necessary.
We should be a powerful part of NATO's forces on the eastern flank. We feel safe because of NATO membership and believe the alliance will protect us, but of course with our participation. Therefore, Poland wants this army to be ready for defense.
But military analysts say there is currently no direct threat from Russia or Belarus to Poland thanks to the presence of NATO troops on Polish soil. Observers also say Wagner Group mercenaries on the Polish-Belarus border are too few to be a significant danger, and the Polish army has learned to deal with provocations from both Russia and Belarus. Lesia Bakalets for VOA News, Warsaw.
Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. Afghanistan's Taliban marked the second anniversary of their return to power on Tuesday, celebrating their takeover of Kabul and the establishment of what they said was security throughout the country under an Islamic system. In the past 24 hours, widening clashes in the Libyan capital are raising fears of a wider escalation. Tripoli's most powerful armed factions battled in several districts in the city's worst violence this year. And the United Nations chief urged the international community on Tuesday to deploy a multinational force comprising of police special forces and military support units to Haiti to combat gangs with sophisticated weapons and restore security to the impoverished Caribbean nation. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. If you think this past July was unusually hot where you live, NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies has confirmed those thoughts since they found July 2023 was globally the hottest month since records were first kept in 1880. The space agency reports that July was 0.24 degrees Celsius warmer than any other July they have logged. They add that it was 1.18 degrees Celsius warmer than the average July between 1951 and 1980. NASA says that especially hot temperatures were noted in sections of North and South America, North Africa, and the Antarctic Peninsula, with an increase in heat by about 4 degrees Celsius above average. To create their report, NASA says they gather temperature data from thousands of weather stations and instruments on ships and buoys. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. A spokesman for the West African regional bloc known as ECOWAS said Tuesday that West African army chiefs will meet in Ghana's capital, Accra, on Thursday and Friday to prepare for a possible military intervention to restore democratic order in Niger. As Timothy Obiju in Nairobi reports, this follows a statement Sunday by Niger's coup leaders that they plan to prosecute ousted Nigerian president Mohamed Bazoum for high treason.
Soldiers of the Presidential Guard overthrew Bazoum on July 26th and have since held the president and his family hostage. If found guilty of high treason, Bazoum could face the death penalty. On Monday, the U.S. State Department criticized the plan to try Bazoum, warning it will worsen tensions in the region. Chris Kwaja is a senior researcher at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He says the junta has no legal standing to pull off a trial because the military government is illegitimate.
For the same government that is a product of unconstitutional means to use the law in prosecuting Bazoum is an exercise of naked power. They cannot exercise authority when they were not given that authority by the people.
ECOWAS has taken a tough stance on the coup in Niger, including border closures and asset freezes in a bid to restore constitutional order. Olawale says there's a possibility the junta, which has suspended the country's constitution, may retain the function of the judiciary for Bazoum's trial.
If they go to court and they prosecute him on that treasonable felony, but I don't think it will get to that end. Pressure is mounting on the Niger regime.
Last week, ECOWAS authorized activation of a regional standby force to reverse the coup if talks with the military government fail. But experts say the force could take weeks to assemble. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Like other migrants fleeing dangerous environments, Afghan refugees who've crossed into the U.S. from Mexico illegally face a number of hardships in rebuilding their lives. VOA's Fahim Siddiqui has the story of one such young man now lives without documents while trying to navigate life and work in the U.S.
Mohammed Siddiq Habibi was once an Afghan soldier, but he now is an undocumented migrant in the U.S. since he crossed the U.S.-Mexico border unlawfully.
We crossed this border and scaled the first wall from that hill and entered the U.S. and we spent one night there.
Habibi's journey began with a humanitarian visa to Brazil. He then embarked on a perilous trek through almost a dozen countries to reach the U.S. border.
We faced many problems. We put our lives at risk by coming here. It took us at least 3 months.
Habibi is one of the thousands of Afghans who have arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum in the recent months. Border authorities recorded a significant rise in Afghan refugees, with over 2,100 apprehended while crossing last year alone, marking an almost 30-fold increase from 2021. Habibi says that after he had been apprehended by border police, he spent 9 days in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection facility. Ghulam Farooq Bashar is an immigration consultant.
When Afghans or others enter the U.S. illegally, the border police apprehend them and tell a
decision is made about them, or, in other words, until they are able to apply for asylum, border security will keep them. But sometimes they are allowed to enter the U.S. on the condition that they appear in the court on a certain date.
Habibi says that he has since applied for asylum, but for now he can neither rent a place nor work because he has no documents.
Currently, I don't have any job in the U.S. I have no work authorization. Our future is not clear in the U.S. for now. I live with my friends.
Habibi envisions a future where he can bring his wife, who remains in Afghanistan, to the U.S., and they can start a new life together. For Fahim Siddiqui in San Diego, California, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
And the music genre hip-hop celebrates its 50th anniversary this year with events across the United States. A Los Angeles art gallery is showing photographs of hip-hop legends. Zhenya Dulo visited the gallery and files this report.
The Morrison Hotel Gallery in Los Angeles is celebrating 50 years of hip-hop with a photo exhibit. American photographer Bob Gruen is showing his picture of Malcolm McLaren, who was one of the pioneers of hip-hop in the early 1980s.
His album, Buffalo Gals, has been sampled by more than hundreds and hundreds of hip-hop other albums that followed. It almost became something you had to do, is take some of Malcolm's sounds in order to make a hip-hop album.
In 1988, photographer Timothy White took the picture of the not-yet-famous rapper Jay-Z.
It's a voice, you know, it's a clear voice of a generation, of a culture that has become something else. You know, it's become sort of part of musical consciousness. It's become something that's of its own genre, and it's powerful. I mean, there's a whole generation. There's 50-year-olds who grew up only on that music.
Photographer Cheryl Fox has been documenting hip-hop stars for decades. She says hip-hop inspires confident women, both in front of the camera and behind it. The 2012 photo of entertainer Rihanna has incorporated various genres into her work.
She's good in her skin, she knows her talents, and she believes in herself. Like, and that's how women make it in hip-hop. They're like unicorns. We're like unicorns. Even people say to me, like, oh my God, like, you captured all these people in this male-dominated space. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, you're a unicorn. But it's, we know who we are as women in hip-hop.
Celebration of the music and the art it has inspired continue throughout 2023, marking 50 years since music scholars say hip-hop was born at the party in the New York borough of the Bronx in 1973. Zhenya Dulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 17th, Russian President Vladimir Putin withdrew from the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which enabled Ukraine to ship its agricultural products unmolested through its Black Sea ports. As part of the deal, United Nations officials agreed to help Russia with its own food and fertilizer exports. In justifying his decision, Putin claimed that the West reneged on this pledge. But there is a problem with Russia's argument, said James O'Brien, head of the State Department's Sanctions Office.
Russia is exporting record amounts of grain. This past year, the Russian Grain Association said that the exports had reached 61.8 million tons of grain, which I believe is 10 to 15% higher than any year before. So if the measurement is food for the globe, then the process we are undertaking with the UN and with Turkey to help Russia export is working. And Russia's complaints amount to minor allegations about a system that is working very well.
Additionally, Russia makes comments about sanctions, said Ambassador O'Brien. I have to emphasize that the U.S. has no sanctions on Russian food and fertilizer. So what's really going on? Ambassador O'Brien proposes that the goal is to reduce the amount of food and fertilizer available so that prices go up and Russia gets attention to some of its demands. About 10% of certain kinds of grains entered the global market from Ukraine. It also delivered as much as half of the food the World Food Program provided for the world's poorest countries. After Russia invaded Ukraine, those exports stopped and prices increased. But with the signing of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, prices dropped again. So that was the situation when Russia decided to do two things, said Ambassador O'Brien.
It terminated the Black Sea Grain Initiative, announced a blockade of shipping out of the Ukrainian ports, said that it would regard any ship going in and out of Ukraine as a subject of military action. And it also began to bombard the food storage facilities.
So that's what Russia is doing. And a consequence is not just the reduction in quantity of food, but prices have jumped substantially, said Ambassador O'Brien. Nonetheless, he said, I'm optimistic that Ukrainian grain will reach global markets. It will take us some time. It's going to involve some costs, but we cannot allow Russia to have a stranglehold over the Black Sea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.